this point of going through the Torah readings that we do through the year, a subject comes up which is a basic subject, which is the mystery of human speech. Let's try to put this into a framework and try to delve as much as we can into the meaning of this area. Try to head towards practical application. I'm not sure in one session we'll manage much of the practical, but perhaps over the weeks ahead, it's a shame we can try to do that. But let's at least try to set the scene by understanding as deeply as possible how important this area is and what it means. And I'd like to do it in perhaps a way that most people aren't familiar with, and that is to look at the five books of Torah. You know, Chumash is five, obviously. And that pattern of five is a reflection of the five levels on which the world is created. We have a very deep idea that the world is built on five layers, or five emanations. In the Kabbalistic literature, they call Pratsufim, which means five faces. But the world is built on five layers, and the fourth of them is called speech. I mean, just to begin and point it out, I mean, something that no one should really miss is that the five books of Torah, right, have names. And the names indicate what they are and how they are expressions or parallel the five levels of creation. Right? So Bereshis, Genesis, means the beginning, and the first level is always the level of something from nothing, right? Something being created where nothing was there before. Each of these words and names, of course, needs tremendous discussion, but that's the first one. The second one we call Shmos, that means names. In English it's called Exodus. I mean, the English names, English or Greek, whatever the names are, is completely irrelevant, really. I mean, they do have something to do with the material, of course, but it's not the Torah name. And the third book we call Vayikra, which is, they call in English or whatever it is, they call it Leviticus, the laws of the Kohanim. But the fourth book that we're going through now is called Bamidbar. That's called Bamidbar, right? That's called in English, what's it called in English?
Numbers.
It's called the Numbers, right? Numbers and Bamidbar have nothing to do with each other. But because it does include a census of the Jewish people, so it's called Numbers, but the real name is Bamidbar, and the final book is called Dvarim, which they call Deuteronomy, meaning it's the second. Deuteronomy really means a second edition or a second time. And of course, again, that has a connection. But the book we're going through now is called Bamidbar. And the word Bamidbar means in the desert. Right? In the desert, Jewish people going through the desert, through all the stages that they, all the stations and stages that they go through on this journey, which takes them from the low point of Egypt to the high point of the border of Israel we're about to go in. That's the classic journey. The 40 years of the journey are always 40 in Torah thinking, is always the levels of pre-birth preparation. The child after 40 days is formed in the womb. By the 40th day, the child is formed. There are 40 weeks of pregnancy. 40 is always the number of stages of preparation before a thing can be born. And that book is called Bamidbar in the desert. But anyone who speaks Hebrew, even very slight connection, slight familiarity with Hebrew, looking at the word Bamidbar will be struck by the fact that it has another meaning as well. And that meaning is? No? No. What does that mean? What does it mean? It means speaking. Bamidbar, midbar, means speech. It means a desert and it means speaking, right? That's very strange. I mean, what does the desert have to do with speech? I mean, is it coincidental that those words, midbar, which is a noun meaning a place of desolation, the root of that word is speaking? What does that mean? And of course, if you think about it for a moment, you realize that the fourth book of the Torah that we're going through now is, first of all, where all the action is, basically, where all the issues are raised, where all the problems arise. All the temptations and ordeals that the Jewish people face in the desert, in that historic journey, right? Basically, they're all documented in this book. And they're all problems of speech. They're all problems of speech. What are the events that we go through in Sefer Bamidbar? Mis'ainanim, the Jews who complained. That's a problem of speech. There's Korach, the rebellion of Korach, which is a argument, machlaikes. That's a speech problem, right? A classic misuse of speech. In fact, it's a Torah prohibition. There's a mitzvah in the Torah not to be like Korach, which means to argue with authority when you're wrong. Of course, you should argue with authority when you're right. I mean, but, you know, with good judgment, of course, and then with diplomacy. But where you're wrong, of course, you should not, and that is machlekes, that's argument. There's Miriam, for example. Miriam speaking against her brother. Miriam and Aaron speaking against their brother, which is the classic problem of Lashon Hara. Speaking slander or libel against someone, right? Which is the classic, in one way, the most basic and most damaging of all Torah prohibitions, in one way. That's called Lashon Hara. And we find it in this book. Not only that, but right after that, we find the sin of the spies, which was Lashon Hara against Israel. They went in to spy the land, and they came back and they gave a bad report. They used speech to denounce the land, and that was the reason, of course, that happened on that led to the great tragedy of Tisha B'Av. The Jewish people cried on that day, and down to this day, that is a day of mourning, because it was a misuse of speech that should have been used in praise of Israel, and that was speech used to denounce Israel and brought about historic tragedy that we've been living ever since. Not only that, but it followed on the heels of the Jewish people witnessing that Miriam and Aaron spoke badly against their brother, and instead of taking the lesson and learning that bad speech, negative speech, is as bad as it is, instead they used their speech for harm. And wherever you look in this book, you'll find that there's a problem of speech. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, hits the rock instead of speaking to the rock. He should have spoken to it. A misuse of speech, a failure to speak. He hit the rock instead of speaking to it. Another major issue it caused his inability was not allowed to go into the land of Israel because of that. And because of that fault, he never went in, never became the messianic persona, and we never entered Israel in that mode of perfection. And of course, we're still living the consequences of that. So as you go through this book, you find time and again there's a problem of speaking. And it's no coincidence that the book of Bamidbar is where all the breakdown of speech occurs. And that obviously is a very provocative idea. We need to try to analyze that and see what it means. By the way, when speech does... Yeah.
What about Zimri?
That's also, Kabbalistically, that's also called speaking. A man's relationship with a woman is also referred to as speech. Also referred to as speech. When the Torah... One second, I'm struggling with him. Have a heart. When the Torah wants to talk about male-female intimacy and it wants to use a euphemism for that, it says they saw, for example, it says a woman was seen speaking. Ra'uha medaberet. They saw her speaking to a man. They saw a woman in seclusion speaking to a man. It doesn't mean speaking. It means engaged in an illicit relationship. But the way we say that in a refined fashion is speaking. There's a very, very close connection between those levels. Or it says, Ishma sapere sebaila, woman speaks to her husband after midnight. Again, it means a close relationship. There's a lot to say about that. But for now, by the way, the word Zimri and Cosby, those two people, right, also are connected. Zemer in Hebrew is a song, and Cosby means a deception, to present yourself in a deceptive. Kazav means deception, treachery in expression. Anyway, there's a lot to say, but for now, that is the book of Bamidbar. When you speak, what do you speak? What do you speak? What do you speak out? Words. How do we say words in Hebrew? Devarim. The fifth book of Chumash is Sefer Devarim. So you get the book of speaking, and the final book is the words that are spoken, right? Devarim. Dibur, right? Midbar and Dibur, Devarim is exactly the same root. Something's going on here, obviously. What is this? What is this issue? Can we get beneath the surface? Can we feel a little bit about what this is? You see, Hebrew is absolutely essential, right? If you don't have Hebrew, there's no hope for you. No hope for you. You have to sign up for Hebrew lessons. You have to come here and take a course so you can learn Hebrew. Torah lives in its medium, right? You have to study it. The only thing more difficult than not speaking Hebrew is if you were brought up speaking Hebrew. That's also problematic. Because then you were used to hearing words in a certain way, and it's very hard to hear them in their correct spiritual mode. You have a big advantage if you speak Hebrew, but on the other hand, you have to break through the shell of familiarity. That's the reason that the Jewish people never used Hebrew. From the first temple times on, in the first temple they spoke Hebrew, but after the destruction of the first temple, the Jewish people never used Hebrew as a spoken language. Right? They maintained it always as the language of spirituality, so it would never get the vessel of familiarity, so that we would always hear it in the wrong way. Even if we were to make up languages like Ladino in the Sephardi world, or Yiddish in the Ashkenazi world. But that's another story. So speaking is, now let's begin by understanding, what has speaking got to do with the fourth level? First of all, why Sefer Bamidbar, the book of traveling through the desert, what does it have to do with the word Dibur? The secret is that a desert is a place of no speaking. A desert is a place where speech is not possible. In Hebrew, the word midbar, dibur, means to speak. Midbar, the Hebrew prefix mi, means to take away from that thing, right? To take away from that. It means to exclude that thing. Yes, when you say from me, it means to take away from, right? You say echad me elef, one from 1,000, take it away from 1,000. Me means to take away. Midbar means to take away from speech. A desert is a place where there's no speech. A desert is a place of a wailing, incoherent sound. The phrase in Hebrew is, the verse says, Betoihu yaleil yishimon. In the wasteland is a wailing that's incoherent. Right? In the desert, you hear a wailing, incoherent sound. A desert is a place of no progress. A desert is a place where there are no roads. A road is a place of coherent progress. It's one step after another, and the road leads you to the destination. What's unique about a desert is wherever you go is the road. There is no road there. The desert is this clear? The desert is a place perhaps second only to the ocean. The ocean is a place where there are no roads. There's no distinction. There are no landmarks in an ocean. The only distinguishing features of the ocean are the place, the shore you left and the shore you're going to. A desert is as close as you can get to that on earth, where there's nothing growing, there's no life, there's a removal from speech. There's a wailing and an incoherence in a desert. Right? That's midbar, and that's why the desert is the place of all the death forces. The Jewish people experience 10 ordeals in the desert, and they fail all 10 of them. Right? All the difficulties, all evil dimensions in the world were ranged against the Jewish people in their journey from Egypt to Israel. The idea was to conquer each of them, to take that spiritual journey and rise one level after another and conquer all 10 dimensions of evil. And in fact, they failed all of those 10 tests. The desert is a place of tremendous death energies where all you have is the incoherence. The Maharal points out in one place, that's why the Ishmael people, the Ishmael peoples, right? I'm not talking about Islam here. Long before Islam arose, they live in a desert. The Arab peoples live in the desert, right? They are people of the desert. And the Maharal explains, because their philosophy is a philosophy, the deep level, the Rambam explains, that the deepest level of Arabic philosophy is that God's ways are inscrutable and you can't know them. Wherever you go is where you are meant to be. Because, right, this is a philosophy called the Kalam. The Kalam is the basis of Islamic philosophy, and it means that wherever you go is what was intended, because God must have meant it if it ended up that way. Right? You can't, ultimately, if you try to fathom what Hashem is, you can't understand Him. And therefore, if you take it all the way down, the world must be inscrutable, you can't understand it. And therefore, there are no pathways that are preordained. Wherever you end up, that must be what was ordained. The Maharal says that's why the early Arab travelers, like the ones who visited Abraham, they worshipped the dust of their feet. You know that. The reason he washed their feet was he didn't want them to bring into his home the vestiges of idolatry. Right? So he washed their feet. They worshipped the dust of their feet. The Maharal says, what does that mean? You know, there's they're fetishes. There's weird idolatrous, you know, focus in the world. But the worship of the dust of your feet, says the Maharal, the dust of your feet is the symbol of the journey. Wherever you ended up, the symbol of the journey is the dust on your feet that got you there. And the holiness of it is wherever the journey took you, that's where the journey was meant to take you. And of course, there's a source for this. There is a deep source for this in Torah. Even though you have your free will and you map out a path, very often in life, the path that you map out takes you someplace completely unexpected. And then you see that was where you were meant to be. It's true. There is a source to this. But it's not, it disagrees thoroughly with the Torah approach. And And despite the fact that ultimately there are things about Hashem we can't understand, nevertheless, we have a mitzvah to understand what we can, and we differ on this point. But the desert is a place which is mufka from dibur. That means it's a place where midbar is a place where there's no cohesive or coherent speech. That's what the desert is. It's a place of wailing and of incoherent noise and deceptive sounds. And that is the meaning. And as the Jews travel through the desert, on the one hand, they receive the Torah there. The positive side of the desert is the fact that since nothing else speaks, truth can be heard. Why was the Torah given in a desert? Because the Torah lives only where nothing else interferes. The Torah is not another option. The Torah is not another spiritual option. There are religions that teach that all great prophets who came to the world, all the non-Jewish so-called prophets in the world, they all had a message to teach. And Moses was one of them. There's a religion like that. Do you know about that? There's a religion that has eight-pointed temple. In Haifa, there's a big center of this. That religion teaches each of the 8 points represents another great prophet. And one of them is Moses. One is the founder of Christianity, and one is the founder of Islam. Sufism. One of them is Moses. That's exactly the opposite of Torah. Torah is not another option which also has a message. Torah exists only when nothing else exists. Torah is the definition of reality. And therefore it's given in a desert. It's not given as one of a range of other options. It's given in a desert where nothing else speaks, where it is the only reality. Therefore it was given in a place where that's all there is. That's the positive side of the desert, is everything else is destroyed. But the negative side of the desert is that there's no coherence. It's not a place of natural coherent speech. The only speech that's there is what you say. And that's why it's not a place of love. It's not a place of love. What does this have to do with the fourth level of five? So here's the secret. The secret is that the world is built on five levels. Actually, these five are really 10. As is well known, there are 10 Kabbalistic emanations. But they are organized in 5 sets, 5 layers. And wherever you look at the world, you'll see there are 5 dimensions to reality. The soul has 5 parts. Hashem's name has 5 elements. Often we're used to regarding these as 4, but of course the reason is only because the first of the 5 is so fleeting. It is the moment of creation itself. You can't grasp that moment. That means when something is created, the moment where it comes into being, of course, as soon as you grasp it, it's too late. Then it's not a coming into being anymore. Is this clear? Hashem's name, for example, it has 4 letters, right? Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei, the 4 letters. But the deep teaching is it actually has 5 elements. The beginning of the first letter, what's called the Kutzer Shel Yud, the little tail of the Yud, is actually the first of 5 elements. Of course, you can't draw it as a separate thing. It's called Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothing. It is the transition from nothing to something. As soon as you can write something on the paper, well, it's too late. Then it's not that's not the something from nothing, that's something. Are we getting somewhere? Every process has a moment where it begins. There's a moment before it begins, that's not here. The moment after it begins is too late. That's when it's here. The transition from the nothing to something is nothing. You can never depict that. Is this clear? If you try to write it down, what will you write? A little dot. So then you've got something. That's not the nothing becoming the something. In sound, when there's a silence and a sound begins, there are 3 stages. There's the silence. There's the silence becoming a sound. And then there's the sound. You can never grasp the silence becoming sound, because as soon as you grasp any sound, it's already too late. It's not the silence becoming sound, that's the sound already. Are we getting somewhere? Is this too abstract for Wednesday night in the summer? And therefore you can't draw it, you can't depict it. So in the beautiful hint is, when we write Hashem's name with 4 letters, the first letter, which is a Yud, which is minimal, a Yud is only a dot. But the Yud itself has a little flick of a tail, which means where the ink begins to manifest on the paper, where the dio manifests on the cloth. It's a hint to this thing that comes before the 4. So there's the first that's called Yesh Me'ayin. It is the transition from nothing to something. And then there are 4 that manifest in the world. So there's always 5. The first, which is inscrutable, ineffable, beyond grasp, and then 4 that come down into the world. But they're really 5. They're 5 books of Chumash, of course. And when the Torah begins, it says, Eile toldos ha-shamayim va'aretz. These are the generations of the heaven and earth. Behi bar'am, in their being created. Behi bar'am, in their being created. Anybody knows Hebrew knows that Behi bar'am also spells Behi bra'am, With five, he created them. In fact, in the Torah, the hay is written small. If you look in the Sefer Torah, you'll see the word behibaram is written, the hay is written small, right? And it spells behay, with this little hay, with this little five, Hashem created the world. Actually, if you know Hebrew, you know that the word behibaram doesn't only mean with five he created them, it also means beh, rearrange the next letters you get, Avraham. Behibaram be'Avraham. With Abraham, with Avraham Avinu, he created the world. On his shoulders rides the world. In other words, the world's created for what he brings to the world, and he's the chariot on which Hashem rides. But the literal reading of that word is behibaram, in there being created, behibaram. And any beginning of is like that. When Joseph gathered the seed of Egypt, and he stored all the seed of Egypt for the dark years, for the famine years, right? When it came time to give out the seed for people to go and plant, so the expression in the Torah is hey lachem zera, was ratem et adamah. Hey lachem means, you can't translate it in English, hey lachem means here is to you. Hey lachem means here's the seed, take it from me. But hey in Hebrew really means here are five for you. Hey lachem, there is five for you. Actually, some deep sources say that all speech begins with a hey. All sound that emanates from the throat before you vocalize it is the sound of the breath, which is a hey. Just the sound of a hey is the primal letter. It's voice, it's breath being produced without yet a vocalization. As soon as you put a sound to it, a vowel, as soon as you vocalize it, it becomes a sound. But as the breath is produced, and before it's given any sound, it's simply hey, which is the letter hey. And therefore it's the root. The five is always the root of all things that are produced in the world. And of course it's why you have five fingers on each hand, and why there are five parts to the soul. And all aspects of the world are built on these five. Five worlds that we inhabit. What are the five parts of the soul? What are the five parts of all ideas? So from the bottom up, the parts of the soul are nefesh. The nefesh is the lowest part of the soul. That's the animal soul, the part that connects with the body, the part that you experience as your cravings and your appetites and your lusts and your sensual aspect. It's where the body speaks, where the mind experiences the body. And of course that we have completely in common with animals. Animals also have the sensations of body that speak to their consciousness, such as it is. That's called the nefesh. Above that is called ruach. Ruach is the consciousness itself, your free will, your awareness, your consciousness, your inner life, all your thoughts. That's called ruach. Above that is a level called neshama, which is very high. In fact, it's so high we really have no contact with it today. It verges on the prophetic. It's a tremendous clarity of spiritual consciousness. And above that are two others called Chaya and Yechida, which are so high we have no contact with them at all. The last time any humans had any contact with them was when Adam was created. He had all five parts to his soul. But nevertheless, those are the five parts. The first one called Yechida, which is the origin of the human being. The next world called Chaya, which is where life begins. The next world called Neshama, which is the essence of the human being. The Hebrew word Neshama really means essence. The root of the Hebrew word neshama is sham. Sham, that root in Hebrew always means essence, right? Sham in Hebrew is the same root as shem, meaning a name. A name always describes your essence. Sham also means final destination. Sham means there. For example, when we talk about the destination of life, we call it shamayim. So in English, they're translated as heaven. But shamayim doesn't mean heaven. Shamayim means kol ha-shamim kulam. It means all the endpoint destination. In Hebrew, it's ridiculous. In English, it's called heaven and earth. Heaven and earth means nothing. In Hebrew, it's called Eretz and Shemayim. Eretz in Hebrew means running towards. Eretz means running and running and running. And final destination in the next world is called Shamayim, all the Shamim. All the Sham, all the endpoint destination of where the journey ends. That's called Sham. And therefore, Shem is a name. Neshama by the way, the word neshama means the essence of the soul, and just like a desert, which is speaking, is the opposite side of desert, which means where there's no speech, neshama also has the Hebrew meaning of shmama, which means desolation. But the same two opposites in that word. And then the next level is called ruach. Ruach is all the inner life, all the movement of the soul. Ruach means movement. Ruach means a wind. It's where there's a movement of spirit. In English it's called the spirit. Maybe. And then the lowest world is called the nefesh, which is not human, which is where you engage the animal. These five parts of the soul, what we experience ourselves as, we experience ourselves in the ruach. our nefesh is animal, that's not, doesn't make you human. The neshama is too high, it's angelic, no contact with that. Where we live is in the world called ruach, and it's the fourth of five worlds. And if you think about thought and action in the world, you'll see it has the same five levels. What are the five levels? The first is called ratzon, which is will, volition. That means the origination of any thought, the will to do a thing. Right? That is the mystical and mysterious source of a human being, is where you have a desire to do something. After that, it's called machshava, which means a thought with no form. The next one down is called hirhur. Hirhur is where the thought takes on a form. In English, you call it imagination, where you actually see pictures of the thing. The next one is called dibur, speech. And the next one is called maisa, action. So the fourth one is called speaking. In other words, the beginning is a volition, a desire, right? That amazing point of something from nothing where a desire flashes into the mind. The moment after that, very, very soon after that, you have a thought. The thought of the thing. The thought of the thing has no shape. Then it moves over to the left-hand side of the mind, as it's called, and that's called hirhur, where the thought takes on a shape and a form. Call it imagination, if you like, where it's given an image. It now makes contact with the physical world, at least in the sense that it gets pictures. By the way, this is where the thoughts of sin always operate. Thoughts of sin never go higher than this. No one ever has thoughts of sin. People have pictures of sin. No one ever had a thought of sinning. You don't have a thought of sinning. You have an imagination of sinning. Thought is too high. Thought without form, they never bothered anybody. What bothers people in terms of illicit fantasy is always the imagination part. It's always the graphic, technicolor, surround sound, you know, stereoscopic. It's where it gets images, where it gets problematic. No one's ever bothered by a thought. It's called hirhur. Hirhur, by the way, is a doubled word. It means where there's the thought and the picture, the root and the manifestation. That's called hirhur. And then you come down into the thing called speech, which is the connection with the world. And then you have maisa, action in the world, or according to some sources, kol and dibur, voice and speech. Voice is the beginning of speech, and speech itself is where the words are produced. But the fourth level down is always called the speaking level. That is where the thought, with its pictures, is now translated into action. Dibur in Hebrew, speech, is always the translation of thought into action. That's what dibur means. It means taking a thought and translating it into the world of action. And that's why the fourth book of Chumash is Bamidbar. The fourth book of Chumash is where you've reached the level of speech, and that's where all the action takes place. Up to there, you have the creation of the world, then you have the Jewish people being formed in the Exodus from Egypt, without going to the golden calf now. Then you have the laws of the priests and Kohanim, that incredible zone halfway between this world and the next, and then you hit the desert, which is where all the problems arise. And as I said before, all the problems are problems of speech. One after another, speech goes wrong in this place of incoherent speech called the desert. And that is where all the action takes place, and all the breakdown takes place. And the final book, the book of Devarim, is what is spoken. That is already the book of preparation for going to Israel. Devarim means the words themselves. Devarim is a preparation. It's a duplication. That's why the English name, the Greek name, is Deuteronomy. It means it's a reduplication. It's where the receiver echoes what he has heard, where it strikes the vessel, reaches the end of the process, and that needs separate explanation. That's called the female dimension. That's why women love Israel. That's why women have a special love for Israel. How do we know that women have a special love for the land? How do we know that? What's the ultimate source of that? Where in the Torah do we see that women have a special demand for Israel? The Bnei Slavchad. The daughters of Slavchad who demanded our share in Israel. And how many daughters were there? Five. Right, when you get to the fifth, you've reached the vessel, that's the woman, connected with land, which is the vessel in which the seed grows and the crop is produced. And that's why the Torah reduplicates. The Rav Shimshon of Hirsch says that in the fifth book of Chumash, all the mitzvahs that are duplicated are the ones that you need for going into Israel. Because the fifth is always the preparation, it's always the place of planting, and that's the preparation. That's the woman, of course, the one who gives birth. And that, of course, needs its own explanation. But the fourth is speaking. And speech in Hebrew means, speech in Torah means, the translation of thought into action. Speech is intermediate between thought, which is silent, and action, which is gross action in the world. Speech is, on the one hand, the minimal expression of ideas in the world, which are thoughts, really. But they do have form, but the form is very ethereal, it's only sound. And therefore, speech, the mouth, is the organ of connection, of bringing a thought into action in the world. And that is what speech is. In Hebrew, the word dibur is very interesting. The word dibur, we translate as speech. But the much deeper root of that word in Hebrew means taking any theory or plan and putting it into action. That's called dabar in Hebrew. One of the meanings of dabar in Hebrew, dibur, is speaking. But the broader meaning is taking a concept and putting it into action. Control. Taking a plan and manifesting that plan in control. Like it says, yadber amim tachtenu. Right? Yadber means for nations to be controlled by another nation. It's got nothing to do with speaking. Or you have the expression, dabar echad lador, a leader of a generation. Dabar doesn't mean spokesman, it means a leader of a generation. Somebody whose plan manifests itself on the ground. Or in Aramaic, the root dabar always means to take and do. Like it says, dabarinu, Hashem took them and placed them. Like it says, when Adam was created, Hashem took him and put him in the Garden of Eden. So it says, vayikachayu, Hashem took him. The Aramaic translation is dabarinu. He took him and moved him. Dibur, dabar, that root in Hebrew means to take a thought and put it into action. The essence of speech is not words that you produce in the world. The essence of speech is taking a thought in the mind and putting it into action in the world. The thought is before the action is after the translation. The movement of a thought into an action is uniquely human. And that's why humans are the only creatures that speak. Without getting into angels' communication and animals. Animals can also communicate. But in a very, very, and animals have something of the human in them. When man was created, the animals were on the level of humans. When Adam was created, animals then were on the level that humans are on now. And animals have a communication, but it's a very, very basic. The articulacy of the human being is what's unique about us. In fact, the Torah calls us uniquely speaking beings. Very interesting. When the Torah describes the formation of a human being, it says that the Hayah Adam la Nefesh Chayah, that man became a living spirit. Nefesh Chayah, that means a living soul. So the Aramaic translation on the spot says L'ruach Memalala, a speaking being. Very interesting. The Aramaic is supposed to be a translation. So the Torah uses the word nefesh chaya, a living nefesh, and he translates it as a ruach speaking. How is that a translation? Nefesh is nefesh, ruach is ruach. But what the Aramaic is teaching us is this, that a living creature called a human is a speaking being. That means when Hashem created a soul that's alive, what's unique about the life of a human being is that the human soul that's alive raises itself to the level called ruach, which is a speaking creature. And therefore, the definition of a human being is the one who can create and connect the angelic world with the physical world. Angels live in a higher world. That's where they are. Animals live in a physical world. What's incredibly unique about a human being is that we can reach up in consciousness into the world of ideas, the world of the angelic, and we can bring them down into the world of the animal. And we are capable of sinking completely to the level of the animal, much more brutal than any animal, and we're capable of raising our consciousness to the level of the angelic. And we make that connection. And that's what speech is. You see this in so many ways. I mean, the most obvious possibly is the mouth is the organ of speech. And the mouth is the organ of connection. This goes into what we spoke about before without going into details. But the mouth is the place of intimate connection. The mouth in the higher world of the head is what intimacy in male-female relationship is in the body in the lower world. The connection is with your mouth you speak, and with speech you create people. With your mouth, you create students. A teacher creates a student with his speech. A parent creates a child with his body. The same faculty. When a person speaks, what is coming out of the mouth is seed energy. That means it's idea energy. That a student who's tuned to his Rebbe, to his master, is built. His spirit is built by his teacher. Whereas a parent brings a child into the world in a much lower way. The parent brings the child into the world in the physical world. This is why you are spiritually closer to your Torah teacher than you are to your parent. You're physically closer to your parent because they brought your body into the world. But you're spiritually closer to your Torah teacher because they brought your neshama into the world. Of course, if you're a parent who teaches a child Torah, then you're both, of course. That's what you should be. You should be a parent who brings a child into the world physically and then you teach a child Torah. Today, many parents can't do that, so you send your child for Jewish education. Then the teachers become your proxies. They become your... But ideally, of course, a father's supposed to transmit Torah to his child, just like he transmits his seed energy into the body of the child. He should transmit his spiritual energy into the Torah mind of his child. That's why Torah should always be heard from the father. You know what's amazing? The Medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to Sinai, He was following the sheep, and he saw the burning bush. Do you remember this? You remember the story? He saw the burning bush long, long before the Jewish people came out of Egypt and stood at that very place. And for the first time in his life, God spoke to him. And he saw this bush that was burning. It wasn't consumed. He was very curious. He walked over, and he heard Hashem speaking. And Hashem said to him, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground. And Hashem began to speak to him. The Midrash says that the voice that he heard when Hashem spoke to him, Hashem addressed him in his father's voice. When Moshe Rabbeinu approached the bush, he heard a voice. He heard a voice for the first time. He became a prophet at that moment. And he heard a voice speaking. But he thought it was his father speaking. Hashem spoke to him in his father's voice. His own father's voice. Right? Amram. The Maharal says, the Midrash says, the reason Hashem spoke to his father's voice was because this was the first time he was hearing prophecy. Moshe Tiron Haya Benavua. He was a Tiron. Tiron means a novice. The first time he ever heard prophecy. And in order not to frighten him, Hashem didn't boom out the voice of God. They would paralyze anybody out of their wits. And therefore, Hashem addressed him in a familiar voice, not to frighten him. Says the Maharal, that wouldn't frighten him. His father had been dead for 53 years. That's not going to frighten him. You're standing in the desert. You approach this bush. You hear your father's voice. That's not going to... What's going on? Says the Maharal, Torah should be heard in the father's voice. What a beautiful message. As the Torah, as Hashem first addresses Avram, he speaks the first words of Torah that he will hear from another world. He hears it in the voice of his father. Because ideally, says the Maharal, that's how a child should hear it. It should come from the parent. Just like the parent brings the body of the child into the world, right? Father and mother. So father and mother bring the child's Torah into the world. The father brings the logical dimension. The woman brings the emunah dimension. The father into the child brings the work of the head. The mother brings the work of the heart. And that's how they form a child. By being together in the educational process, that's how the child is built spiritually. And just like there's a marriage between the parents that forms the child, there should be a marriage in the child between the head and the heart. Right? So that both of those dimensions are operating together, and that is the spiritual creation of the child. And therefore, the mouth is the organ of creation. It's the organ of connection, male-female connection. The mouth has three functions, and all functions are functions of connection. The mouth has three functions: eating, speaking, and kissing. Those are natural human functions. They're all functions of connection that generate something in the world. Eating. What is eating? Eating is the activity you do to keep the soul connected with the body. The soul is considered male, the body is considered female. Again, without going into the details. But eating is what's necessary to keep the two together. If you don't eat, the soul becomes faint, which means it starts to lose its connection with the body. You become faint and dizzy, and eventually, if you don't eat long enough, the soul snaps out of the body. Eating is a special creation. What is food? What is food? Food is the creation of an energy that keeps soul in body. Nothing in the world can live unless... Nothing in the world can have its soul connected with its body unless it eats. In Kabbalistic writings, it says the angels also eat. Even the higher emanations of light from the higher world, they're also fed. Nothing can live in the world. Nothing can keep the light in the vessel unless food energy keeps these two opposites together. These are things that reject each other. They oppose each other. They repel each other. And food... So when you eat, what you're doing is you're keeping the soul in the body. By the way, that's why the world needs to eat. Where does the world eat? The sacrifices that are offered in Yerushalayim, the korbanos, is where the world eats. And the Shachaim says, you look carefully, you'll see that all the expressions of the sacrifices in Jerusalem are expressions of eating. It's korbani lachmi, my sacrifice is my bread. The altar is called shulchan gavoa. All the laws of the sacrifices are laws of meals. You have to have salt always, and all the details of the sacrifices are the laws of food. What is that doing? Just like the human body needs food to keep the soul in the body, the world needs food to keep the Shekhinah in the world. Right? And that's what the work is in the temple, is the place of maintaining that connection. So one of the functions of the mouth is eating. Why does the mouth have more than one function? Why? Why does one part of the body have more than one function? Why didn't Hashem create the body that each function has a part? So all the deep sources indicate that when one part of the body has more than one function, it must be that those functions are connected. That's why one part of the body does those things. Take any part of the body, the nose. Why does the nose smell and breathe and sneeze? They're all the same thing. We haven't got time now to go into what it is. But any part of the body that does more than one thing, those things are always emanations of the same. The mouth has three functions. They're all connections. Eating is the connection of soul and body. Speaking is the connection of ideas with the physical world. It's taking an abstraction and connecting it to physicality. It's the connection between people, a very intimate connection, very intimate connection. When you speak, you can be more intimately connected with somebody than when you're connected with them physically. Because the minds can mesh through speech. And speech isn't only words, of course. A gesture, an expression is also speech. Any translation of an inner theme into an outward expression, you can tell if a person's wise by the way he walks, says the Gemara. Doesn't have to be words only. But that's called speaking. And kissing. Kissing is the natural mechanism of people expressing a love for each other. Right? It's bizarre. It's completely bizarre. Completely bizarre. You want to show somebody you love them, so you put your mouth on them? It's absurd. It's unhealthy. It's medically risky. It's completely unnatural. There's nothing natural about it. If you were a Martian and you had to design a way of these things called humans showing affection for each other, you know, come up with something sensitive. You know, you'd come up with, I don't know, touching eyelashes, rubbing ears, maybe sort of putting foreheads together. Put your mouth on them? Ridiculous. As a mother wants to show affection for a baby, she just slobbers over it and spits on it. But the mouth is an organ of connection. And just like you can speak to somebody, the mouth is the tool, the organ of engagement, right? And it's a source of life connection. And that's what speaking is. You know, the neck is the organ of connection of the head and the body. The head is always the world of thought, and the body is the world of action. Right? The head is the place of the three higher emanations that have no visibility in the world. And then the neck connects them with the world of action. And the voice is formed in the neck. Why is the voice formed in the neck? Because the neck is the place of connection of the higher world, of the head of thought with the body. And therefore the voice is formed. The neck is always an organ of connection. Why do you have a neck? I could have walked around back there. Why did God make you with a neck? The neck is the place, the organ of connection between the higher world. In Torah thinking, the neck always means the temple. The Beis HaMikdash, the Bet HaMikdash, is always called the neck of the world. Always, wherever you look. K'migdal tzavarech, it says in Shir HaShirim, speaking about a beautiful woman and talking about the elegance of her neck. So all the commentaries there say that this beautiful woman that's been discussed over there, the image there means, Shlomo Melech's talking about the temple. The temple is the place of connection of the higher world with the lower world. By the way, what happens in the temple? What happens in the Beis HaMikdash? All the functions of connection. Eating, that's where the sacrifices are offered. Speaking, that's where the voice of Hashem is heard from between the two golden kerubim, which incidentally are male and female, embracing each other. That's Hashem meeting the Jewish people. The young husband and wife embraced in love. Those are the two golden kerubim representing Hashem and us. And from between the two kerubim is where the voice is heard, obviously. And the temple is the place of kissing, apart from the two, that image. It says, Asra Damnashki Shmayav Arar, where heaven and earth kiss. Where heaven and earth kiss, where there's a point of meeting, intimate meeting between, just for those who have a sense, a sensitivity, the temple is in a place called Tzion. Tzion, right? Tzion. Tzion Michlal Yoifi. Tzion is the place of exquisite beauty. Tzion, what in English is called Zion. Tzion is the same numerical equivalent as the word Yosef. And the Medrash says, whatever happened to Joseph happened to Tzion. Right? Tzion. Tzion in Hebrew means the most beautiful. Tzion means, Mitzuyan means the place that is marked out as special. Tzion means a place of significance that's marked out special. The center of the world. What is Joseph? Who is Joseph? Who is Yosef? He's called Yesod in Kabbalistic writing. He's the connection between male and female. Joseph is the place of connection, circumcision, the bris, male and female meeting, impurity. That's what Yerushalayim is. It's the place of the higher world and the lower world meeting, which is called the neck of the world where the two meet. And therefore, that is the place of speech where Hashem's voice is heard. In Yerushalayim, it's called the Mishkan, the Mikdash. In the desert, it was called the Mishkan. But that is the background. And so, in summary, what we learned this evening, we didn't speak about anything practical. I know that. It's Hashem, maybe next time we can take this forward into the practicalities with a little of understanding of this idea of how speech is the fourth of the levels of the soul, of the levels of thought and action in the world. And Ruach is the fourth of the levels of soul in the world. And Ruach is where all the action takes place. It's the connection. The Ruach is the place of free will. Free will is the ability, do you decide to go down to the animal and connect with the body, or do you decide to reach up into the angelic? Right? That's where all the decision, all the action, all the tension is taking place. And therefore, it is the speaking world. It is where the fourth book of the Torah describes Bamidbar in the desert, Bamidaber, the world of speaking. And this is the clue as to why the sins of speech in the Torah are the most serious of all sins. This is what's wrong with lying, for example. Because when you lie, you're misusing speech. What is a lie? What's wrong with lying? What's wrong with lying? Why is it so immoral? Because the reason what speech is takes an idea in my head and it shares it with you. What is a lie? When I share with you what's not in my head. It's a betrayal, a treachery of speech. It looks like speech. It's from the lip out. But it's not a connection with what's in me. So it's intrinsically immoral. You're taking a tool and breaking it. You're not using it for what it was created for. The creation of speech is to take something unrevealed in me and to reveal it in exquisite, articulate terms to you. And what I'm doing is I'm betraying that idea. I'm speaking something to you that is not what's in me. And that's the natural immorality of lies. Lashon hara. Lashon hara means when you use speech for harm. The holiness of the human being, what makes you uniquely human, the ability to create human beings, right, in the highest sense by teaching. And you take that faculty of speech that nothing else has in the world. No other creature speaks like that. And you take that and use it for harm. That's called Lashon Hara. The Gemara says in one way it's worse than murder, idolatry, and immorality. Why so bad? Because the essence of who you are is a speaking being. And when you take, by the way, when the spies, we learned about this week. That's the parsha. The spies come back from Israel, they give a bad report. That's called Lashon Hara. Why? There's no law in the Torah about speaking bad about a country. Lashon Hara is when you speak bad about a person. When you reveal something true that's bad about a person. There is no prohibition about speaking about a country. There's no prohibition. The prohibition of Lashon Hara is when you say bad about a person. Speaking bad about a country is totally allowed. So why is that the source of Lashon Hara? Because the message is that the root of Lashon Hara is using speech for harm. It isn't only bad-mouthing a person and saying what's true. That's the specific halachic application. But the misuse of speech in the first place, that's the root of the problem. When they came back and they used the human faculty of speech, they can build worlds. That is an essence, an essential expression of what the human being is. And they used that faculty to do harm, to betray and to damage the Jewish process of moving into Israel, which is ultimate connection of spirit and body, the Jewish people and their land, in the most fruitful of all relationships. And they block that with speech. There's nothing. And therefore the plague that they suffered involved their tongues. That should be clear. And that's why in Judaism, right, our speech is so precious that we never say words that are, even if we say words that are harmful, we always deflect them and change them in case they, because words always produce in the world. The Gemara says that if a person utters a curse, even if accidentally it will come to pass, a person powerful enough. Today our words are so cheap. Today our words are so vomited out with no meaning at all that they have no power to. Today you can say whatever you like, it means nothing. No one believes you in the first place. But when speech was still in its zone of precious potency, so then when a person said a thing, the Gemara says that if a righteous person utters a curse, even if he's mistaken, it will come to pass. When Yaakov said, whoever in whosever possession the idols are found will die, Rachel died, his own wife, even though he never would have meant it. But he said the words. That's why we never say, when the Talmud has a curse type expression, it suddenly changes it to the third person. It says, you, and then it comes to something bad, and it says, he. You shouldn't even say, you should be, and then say a word of curse, even if you're saying it to somebody and just reading words. You know, we'll have to have a separate talk about it. The consequences of Lashon Hara are gruesome. Gruesome. I don't think you want to hear about it. They are gruesome. Speaking bad about somebody, which is revealing something true about them, not lying, something true, which is bad, is heinous. The Gemara says it's worse than almost anything else you can conceive. Not something you want to do. Not something you want to do. From now on, you get rid of your cell phone, you grind your telephone to a powder, you... Talk about the weather. You just talk about the weather. That's it. The Chofetz Chaim's wife used to stay home. She didn't go to shul. She said, Alein is the neshama rein. When you're alone, the soul stays pure. Start gossiping and gabbing and jabbering.
If our words are so diluted in the generations, you said it lacks the same power. Why does the halacha hold the same level?
Still forbidden. Of course it's forbidden. But the damage that's caused at our level,
if
we are so low.
Then
yes. Oh, so you can do whatever sins you like because we're
exactly.
Very low. Yeah. Think again. Nice try, but... So, Emes Hashem, that is a summary of the ideas of speech and their power. That is why you have to guard speech so carefully. Now you can begin to understand the Gaon of Vilna, when he left for Israel, when he's preparing to go an Aliyah, he wrote a letter to his family. I mean, once we're frightening ourselves, we might as well terrify ourselves. Yeah. So let me tell you what he writes. The Gaon of Vilna writes that he says, especially guard your speech. And then he writes to his family, because for every unnecessary word, unnecessary, we're not talking about forbidden speech, we're not talking about bad stuff, just an unnecessary word, for every unnecessary word you utter, in the next world you will be flung from one end of the universe to the other in a thing called the kafakela. Kafakela means the slingshot. That means the punishment for unnecessary words, what's called dvarim batalim. Dvarim batalim, that means words that are unnecessary, is that you will be flung from one end of the universe to the other, and just as you're about to satisfactorily arrive, you get flung again. Because it's a journey that never ends. What are words? Words are an expression of your essence. It is seed energy, essential energy of the human being that is productive in the world. And you're using it for nothing, just meaningless words? So the consequence of that in the next world is being undertaking a journey that never arrives. That's called dvarim batalim, right? Unnecessary words. We're not talking about bad stuff. We're just talking about meaningless chatter. Meaningless chatter. When you ask somebody how they are, you do somebody a favor, you encourage somebody, you say something kind. Of course, that's a mitzvah. But unnecessary words, and I hate to tell you this, men do it much worse than women. Much worse than women. If you listen to women talking nonsense to each other, you'll hear a lot of useful information is being exchanged. When men talk nonsense, they talk complete garbage. Men can get together and spend hours talking about sports statistics from 40 years before. It's got no meaning at all, completely irrelevant. A sport that means nothing in the first place. And they're talking about who kicked how many, you know. And they can go on for hour after hour after hour. Total garbage. Anyway, we'll have to speak about this. So in summary, what we learned tonight is that our words are precious. The words are an expression of who you are. Just like none of your energy in the world can ever be expressed in a meaningless and a wasted fashion. Right? Least of all, the compressed essence of a human being that are his and her words.